From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the eve of the centenary of her birth, novelist, philosopher Ayn Rand, author of the perennial bestsellers Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, remains remarkably resonant in American politics and culture. Rand was born Alyssa Rosenbaum in St. Petersburg, February 2, 1905. She died in New York in 1982, but her belief in the virtue of selfishness and her disdain for altruism as the road to mediocrity continued to beguile armies of readers every year, some of them going on to be mighty power brokers. Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan came under her spell, so did Clarence Thomas and millions of other readers. Her heroes strive against all odds, against society, against the forces that would hold their talent down. In the 1949 movie of Ayn Rand's best-selling novel, The Fountainhead, Gary Cooper starred as the ambitious architect Howard Roark, striving for success on his own terms.
I came here to say that I do not recognize anyone's right to 1 minute of my life, nor to any part of my energy, nor to any achievement of mine, no matter who makes the claim. It had to be said. The world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrificing. I came here to be heard in the name of every man of independence still left in the world. I wanted to state my terms. I do not care to work or live on any others. My terms are a man's right to exist for his own sake.
An unapologetic obsession with the self is at the heart of Rand's philosophy, and it's what keeps droves of readers flocking to her books. Tonight on Point, the radical individualism of Ayn Rand and its resonance in American politics and culture today, 100 years after her birth. You can join the conversation tonight. Have you taken the Ayn Rand plunge? Have you stayed there or moved on? Have you found the thrill of the self in Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead? Are we living in Ayn Rand's America? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Scott McLemy, essayist at large for the online publication InsideHigherEd.com. He writes reviews and essays on politics and culture. In 1999, he wrote The Heirs of Ayn Rand: Has Objectivism Gone Subjective for Lingua Franca? Scott McLemy, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me.
There's a lot we want to hear from you, but first off, who was Ayn Rand?
Well, as you said in the introduction, Ayn Rand was born in Russia, what was at that time Russia. She left after the Bolshevik Revolution in the early 1920s, came to the United States, worked in Hollywood for a time as an actress, and worked on making costumes, as I recall, and was by force of will, as much as anything else, created herself anew in the United States as a writer, a novelist, but also a philosopher of a kind.
Her father's pharmacy in St. Petersburg was taken over by, Bolshevik or communist collectivists. She was a lifelong opponent of anything that smacked of collectivism, even of what might be called social responsibility.
Very much so, and yet the thing that I'm really struck by, and I'm certainly not an Ayn Rand enthusiast, I'm fascinated by her and by her legacy, but I've never really, it's never really appealed to me. But in reading her work over time, I've always been struck by how much, even though she rejected everything about communism, there is this quality in her fiction of say the socialist realist novel in which communism is scratched out and capitalism is written in. The old joke has it that the Soviet novel was Boy Meets Tractor, and with Rand's novel sometimes it's more like a Girl Meets Skyscraper.
Or Howard Roark, just resplendent in the morning sun, on top of a cliff. The icon of power. It does have a kind of Soviet feeling, even if, as you say, it's capitalism, not communism.
Well, and also in Atlas Shrugged. I mean, think about it for just a second. The whole premise of this novel is that all of the creative capitalist innovators and good guys around the world are horrified by the mediocrity engulfing them and the strikes and the welfare state and everything. What do? They have a strike. You know, it's really almost like something out of a proletarian culture novel from the 1920s. They all go on strike and they go off and they live in this valley and they create a sort of a commune there,
right,
of these radical individualists. And you know, this is an irony, I guess, that is probably lost on the average 16-year-old picking out one of the novels, and I'm sure that probably any true believing Randite would probably be apoplectic to have that comparison made. But it is very striking, and a quite brilliant American scholar who's worked on Rand very seriously, named Chris Matthew Sciabarra, has a book called Ayn Rand, the Russian Radical, in which he really digs into this stuff and finds a lot of ways in which Rand, who is very much an American figure, and although her work has been translated into a couple of dozen languages, my impression is that she's still her appeal is very specifically American in a lot of ways.
You write what you describe what you call a kind of Ayn Rand reader syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Describe that for us.
Well, the way it usually happens is that somebody's about, you know, 15, 16. They come across one of these novels. It's pushed on them by a friend, someone in high school, maybe a teacher, or maybe one of your friends gives it to you, and you read it, and you're swept away. This notion that there is a virtue in selfishness. She has a book of essays called The Virtue of Selfishness. The notion the movie that you played the excerpt from there is just, it's a wonderful movie.
The Fountainhead, Gary Cooper, kind of camp, but it's all there.
It's utterly camp, but it's incredibly enjoyable at that level. I used to see it on Saturday afternoon TV as a kid, and there something about that sort of defiant statement of I am me and I am for me and I don't owe you, the world, anything. You are lucky to have me. I'm sorry, you know, there's something very sort of adolescent about that. And I don't say that in a bad way. I mean, everybody sort of has to go through that phase. And you can do it in various ways. But Rand has become this kind of rite of passage for, at this point, I don't even know how many generations. You know, it goes back to the 40s.
And it goes on and on. Scott McLemy, do you see the thumbprint of Ayn Rand in American political conversation today? In American conservatism today?
Yes and no. Certainly at the time in the 50s and 60s, especially in the 50s, but by the 60s, when she was really making a mark on young readers, the notion that there was anything good about capitalism was definitely not abroad in the political culture. And in that sort of pre-Barry Goldwater era, I think there was, I have the impression there was something really bohemian about this this kind of thing. And it was a magnet for bright young people. And that has certainly, I mean, a lot of that has changed in the meantime. There's a very good book about the early history of anti-state kind of free market radicalism by a fellow named Jerome Tusiel, published in 1972. And when he wanted to talk about people being drawn to that kind of politics, he titled it, It Usually Starts with Ayn Rand. And I think that's probably still true in some ways. On the other hand, Rand's worldview is very much atheistic. And so that's certainly not, you know, what you associate with conservatism.
Doesn't fit with the Christian right angle of conservatism today. Scott McLemy, thanks for the quick introduction. Wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks again.
I turn now in Washington to Edward Hudgens. He is executive director of the Objectivist Center. It's an advocacy group dedicated to principles of objectivism, the philosophy developed by Ayn Rand. Edward Hudgens, thanks for being with us tonight.
Good evening. How are you doing?
We're great. We're also joined tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Hello, Jack. Good to have you along.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Edward Hudgens, take us straight to the heart of Ayn Rand. What's the most important thing to understand about her worldview, her teaching?
I would say a couple of things. First of all, as you mentioned, the virtue of selfishness. But this is not an atomistic selfishness that advocates stealing and looting and so forth. It is the notion of your own happiness, your own joy in life, your own fulfillment should be your goal. And by the way, I put Ayn Rand in the tradition of Aristotle, who said that pride is the crown of all the virtues, incidentally. And Ayn Rand was a great admirer of Aristotle. But this notion that you don't have to apologize for living in this world, you don't have to apologize for wanting to get the best out of life, the best out of yourself, to reach your full potential. The second thing that I think is crucial about Rand is that she put this into a consistent, well-reasoned philosophy because you can find a lot of these ideas in the Enlightenment tradition of John Locke, Jefferson, mm-hmm. Benjamin Franklin, respect for reason, individual liberty, which of course Rand was a big proponent of, and the like. But she brought it together and really synthesized it and made her own contributions, unique contributions, to how we understand and justify selfishness and what it is based on, man's nature as a rational creature with free will.
And was her idea that if everyone was sufficiently selfish, the whole world would be better off, or some individuals would be better off?
Well, both. Each individual would certainly be better off who acts in their own rational self-interest. And I have to underline the word rational. Her idea of self-interest is not someone who goes out and does drugs, someone who destroys their mind, who gives into the whim of the moment. But this is the interesting, some people might see it as an irony, is that if everybody acts in this way, seeking the best within them, this is going to be a society in which you really want to live, because you're going to see a lot of other people doing great things. It's better to deal with people who you consider to be honest, trustworthy, with integrity, and so forth, creative people. There was a great quote from The Fountainhead, where there's a character kind of riding through the countryside, deciding what to do with his life, and he's thinking to himself, "Don't work for my happiness, my brothers. Mm-hmm. Show me yours. Show me your achievement, and the knowledge will give me courage for mine." So this is the kind of society that you would want to live in, because not only would you be able to achieve the things that you want to achieve, but you would be able to see other people doing that. It would give you spiritual fuel and inspiration.
Edward Hudgens, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about the radical individualism of Ayn Rand and its remarkable resonance in American politics and culture today, 100 years after her birth in pre-Soviet Russia. You can join the conversation. Have you taken the Fountainhead plunge run with Atlas Shrugged recently or years ago? Did Ayn Rand make you a romantic egoist? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the radical individualism of Ayn Rand and its remarkable resonance in American politics and culture today, 100 years after her birth in pre-Soviet Russia, February 2nd, 1905. I'm joined tonight from Washington by Edward Hudgens, Executive Director of the Objectivist Center. It's an advocacy group dedicated to the principles of objectivism, the philosophy promoted by Ayn Rand, and by our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation as well. Was Ayn Rand an important figure in your intellectual development? Did you outgrow her, or is she still pointing the way for you? Do you buy the core Rand belief in the virtue of selfishness? Did you see Ayn Rand's thinking at work in Scorsese's The Aviator, in Pixar's The Incredibles, heroes who won't be kept down? And what do you think? Do self-sacrifice and altruism just promote mediocrity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Here's a bit of Ayn Rand from a 1959 interview with Mike Wallace. You'll hear her Russian accent. Here she's talking about living as a human being, holding on to reason as an absolute.
My morality is based on man's life as a standard of value. And since man's mind is his basic means of survival, I hold that if man wants to live on Earth and to live as a human being, he has to hold reason as an absolute, by which I mean that he has to hold reason as his only guide to action, and that he must live by the independent judgment of his own mind, that his highest moral purpose is the achievement of his own happiness.
Achieving his own happiness. There's Ayn Rand in a 1959 interview with Mike Wallace. Jack Beatty, I hear echoes of the ownership society. It may be a very pale imitation of what Ayn Rand would have sought for her superheroes, but is that our contemporary nod to Ayn Rand?
Well, sure. I mean, we're talking about taking the social and possibly the security out of social security. So, yes, I mean, I think that that is an echo. But, you know, I think that it's good for the fraying social conscience of our time that President Bush's favorite philosopher continues to outsell Ayn Rand every year.
That would be Jesus Christ.
That would be Jesus Christ and the Bible. And, of course, the main ideological opponent of capitalism for a long time was socialism, but now, and really for a long time, it's been Christianity. Mm. It's been the Sermon on the Mount. It's been the man who says that if you live for yourself alone, you're not living. It's been a religion based on self-sacrifice. It's been somebody who says that the essence of life is love, and the essence of love is sacrifice. So Ayn Rand and the sort of philosophy of capitalism, as opposed to something we accept because it works, is up against a very strong tradition in Western thought, and one that's very strong among Mr. Bush's followers.
Edward Hudgens, how about it? What do you think Ayn Rand would make of the direction of American society and politics? On the one hand, as Scott McElhinney was saying earlier, capitalism is in much better odor today than it was when she arrived in the 30s and 40s among intellectuals in the States. On the other hand, Christianity, fundamentalist Christianity, hasn't been bigger in a long time. What would you make of that combination?
I think it's an accurate description that, and I think it is in part because of Ayn Rand that capitalism has a better reputation than it did when she came to this country, and in fact, coming from the horrors of Soviet Russia. Had to listen to intellectuals in this country talk about what a wonderful place Russia was and how wonderful communism was. And, of course, history as well as philosophy has shown that that's not the case. And I think she would see her own influence, in fact, in the thinking of many people. By the way, we're having a big event on Capitol Hill tomorrow, February 2nd, and there's a member of Congress speaking. We have another member of Congress who has a piece in our monthly publication. I can name governors and other people who are influenced by Rand and who took part of her arguments. But you're right on the other side. This is part of why we need, in the title of what we're going to retitle our publication, The New Individualist, why we need a new individualism in this country. Because, as Rand suggested, reason is our guide to discover not only facts about reality, but what will give us the most happiness and satisfaction in life. Christianity is really kind of a mix and a hash today. You can listen to Christians who talk about, for example, the need to have self-discipline. I'd say, okay, that sounds pretty good, right? Mm. You can listen to Christians who say that we shouldn't be complete nihilists. Again, that's pretty good. And I could go down the list of things that I think are, you know, account for its appeal in a very nihilistic society that still has a lot of violence and bad stuff. On the other hand, I think the Christians are wrong if they think that mere faith is the way to a better society or to individual happiness. And to the extent that they say individual happiness is not the goal, well, then I would simply have to reject that and say self-sacrifice is morally an evil thing. And by self-sacrifice, by the way, I don't just mean, you know, you help out a poor person, you give them some money or something like that. I mean that you take what is most, can I use this word, sacred in your own soul, what you really love. Perhaps you want to be a medical doctor. Perhaps you aspire to run your own business, whatever it is, to take that thing you most love, perhaps the woman or the man that you most love, the children that you most love. True self-sacrifice is throwing those things away for a lesser value, to quote the Bible, casting your pearl before swine. And
of
that,
course,
to me, is vile.
Ayn Rand was very disdainful of faith itself. She called it, what, arbitrary?
Yeah, exactly, because what exactly is faith? Faith is an unreasoned, unsubstantiated belief. Now, there are things that we can say that we don't know completely and that deserve more study and examination, and that's all fine. We have to keep open in that way. But the idea of faith, where I come up, I'm discussing something with you, and at a certain point you just say, I don't care what the evidence is. I don't care what the reasoning is. I simply accept it. I'll give you an area, by the way, where this crops up. It's at this point a minor area, but it kind of is a bit of a bother. A lot of people who reject the notion of evolution, even though all of the scientific evidence points to some form of evolution, that is, human beings evolved from lower creatures, and the only question is, how did it happen? Punctuated equilibria, or did it happen in a smooth way, or the causal agents?
Right.
But that's kind of an example of people who simply say, look, don't confuse me with the facts. I simply believe that the world was created, you know, man was created in, you know, in a poof or, you know, or whatever.
And Ayn Rand would have had no patience for that. It's fascinating. It seems, Jack, as though the American conservatives have the same kind of tension within their ranks these days, because, of course, not everybody is an all-out Christian who's conservative by any means. On the other hand, it's now sewn right into the heart on that side.
It is, and it is on this issue of self-sacrifice and selfishness that the lines are drawn. I mean, if self-sacrifice is vile, then I'm really glad that my parents were such vile people. I mean,
but you're misdefining self-sacrifice.
They never went to a movie. They never brought a new car. They never took a vacation. They never did anything except support and protect and nurture their family. And boy, am I glad that their
lives
are self-sacrificing.
But you see, this is a misunderstanding of self-sacrifice. I mentioned,
okay,
for example, you love your children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
That's why you have them, is because you want to take this little baby and nurture them so that they are mature, self-sufficient, personally responsible adults. That is your goal. That's the thing that you love. And so it's a matter of, well, I can have a new toy, or I can help, raise this wonderful child that I've had. That's not self-sacrifice. Or again, if you do something, if you give up buying a new car because your wife or your significant other is sick, or your parents, okay, that is not self-sacrifice. That's taking the thing that you most love in life and putting it first and having your priorities straight.
Edward Hudgens, that's the
idea of true self-interest does not mean that you want to stomp all over other people.
We've got it. The line gets difficult to follow at some points. So I want to bring another voice into our conversation here. From Notre Dame in Indiana, James Sturba joins us. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Notre Dame. James Sturba, thanks for being with us tonight.
Yes, I'm happy to be here.
So you must have watched or seen the allure of Ayn Rand over the years, young readers picking it up, diving in and coming out romantic egoists and empowered individualists. You're a philosopher. How do you look at what Ayn Rand laid out, how it fits into the kind of mainstream or not of 20th century philosophy? How do you look at it today?
Well, I think it's an interesting view, and I think its main contemporary area is developed in terms of libertarianism. But my problem is I don't think the theory works very well. I mean, I don't think you can start off with self-interest and get to morality, even libertarian morality. And if you start off with libertarian morality, I don't think you get to laissez-faire capitalism, as Rand thought, but I think you get to a welfare state. So for me, it's just a question of entailment of these ideas. Self-interest doesn't get you to morality. Libertarian morality doesn't get you to laissez-faire capitalism, but gets you to the welfare state.
You better describe that path for us. I'm sure Edward Hudgens won't buy it, but how do you draw that line?
Well, I mean, again, the issue of self-interest, I mean, we just had some discussion of that. I mean, but there are lots of times when what I want to do conflicts with someone else having enough to eat. Now, if I do what I just want to do, my own self-interest, someone else might starve. Someone on my doorstep might starve. So it can't be that just following your self-interest always gets you to morality. I would think that would be very
How do you immoral. Define morality? Define morality, please.
Morality is going to be an issue about when my self-interest has to be sacrificed for others. You can't have everybody having their self-interest fulfilled all the time. You know, our self-interest right now conflict, yours, mine, everyone on this panel. Self-interest doesn't, there's always these conflicts, and you have to decide whose self-interest should trump in these conflicts.
And you see, by the way, this is the key insight of Rand that she would reject what you're saying, is that there are no essential conflicts between rational individuals, that it's not a dog-eat-dog world where, you know, either I have to eat and you starve, or you have to eat and I starve. And by the way, for the most part, those kind of inequalities come from a statist system. And I helped develop an index of economic freedom, by the way, at the Heritage Foundation, and the Cato Institute puts one out too, which demonstrates this. But the point is, you're defining morality. Why you've got to get something to something more basic.
Well,
why should I give a damn about these things?
Morality.
Define it, please.
Let's
no, I want to start with objectivist morality.
You're saying why should you give a damn about someone starving? Is that the question, Edward Hudgens?
I think it's a valid question. Now, what I'm asking is this: let's not just start with libertarianism, because remember, I'm an objectivist. Okay, I believe that you need an objective basis of value in order to derive and to justify a free society. You don't start by, you start basically with the fact that we are each individuals, that we each have free will, that we each have a rational mind, that the basic fundamental alternative for each human being is to survive or not to survive.
And then we're talking Ayn Rand. I want to let some individuals into this conversation who've been waiting patiently. Alan's calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Alan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind, Alan?
I wanted to say that when I was a young person, I read Ayn Rand, and it was very attractive to me, the sense that, well, the virtue of selfishness. Mm-hmm. But then later, in my own personal philosophy, at least, I had to learn to temper it with a certain measure of self-sacrifice.
And why? What was it about life experience or your further thinking that brought you to that?
Well, I learned more about other philosophies and other movements, things like the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, where self-sacrifice played a huge part in those movements. And if it wasn't for at least a certain measure of self-sacrifice, then those movements may not have come about.
Ever heard you speak to that for a moment? Those kind of social movements that bring a kind of general advance in our understanding of liberty, at least that's how they're commonly understood, do they not depend on somebody sacrificing for somebody else?
Well, the thing is, again, it's a matter of how you define sacrifice. And I think that if the mm-hmm. standard is man's life or human beings' life as rational creatures with free will, then that clarifies the issue a lot. For example, if you look at the famous phrase, give me liberty or give me death, Patrick Henry's, okay? Is it really self-sacrifice to say I refuse to live as a slave? Is it really self-sacrifice for somebody to say, I'm going to go into battle because, after all, the alternative is to live as a slave?
But what about when someone else is living as a slave?
I think that if someone else is living as a slave, first of all, you're not obliged to kill yourself for somebody else. Now, it might well be that, for example, if a loved one is maybe being held hostage, okay?
But does that make the Civil War, does that mean the Civil War was a mistake for those Union soldiers who died?
Well, the Civil War had a lot of problems, quite frankly. But I think that we never should have had slavery in the Constitution, and that's just a whole other issue. My bottom line is that ultimately, I don't owe it to anybody. For example, to go and to volunteer and to die for Iraqis. Now, if others want to do that, that's fine. And if we have some national interest, let's say, in going into Iraq, and I don't want to get into the whole for or against the war issue, then that's another issue as well. If we think it's for the defense of the country, so that in fact we won't have Islamic nuts, who, by the way, are the perfect fusion of faith and force, are these Islamists. They're the perfect Ayn Rand villain. I don't have an obligation to do that. To go and sacrifice myself for others.
Well, let's have another call here. Christine is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Christine. You're on the air.
Hi. I find this conversation incredibly interesting. I like your first guest who compared Ayn Rand's philosophy to adolescence. When I was growing up, it was the 60s, I read The Fountainhead, and I was incredibly fascinated by the book.
A lot of draw there at that age, isn't it?
Unbelievable. And then I saw the movie with Cary Grant. You know, this idea of...
Gary Cooper.
I'm sorry, Gary Cooper, yes. You know, the idea of this amazing sense of integrity and honesty that was portrayed in that character, Howard Roark. However, I find it rather horrifying that now that I'm in my 50s, that she's still popular. I can hear the guests all sort of arguing the sort of semantics about what it means to be selfless and selfish. But to me, happiness is not something personal. I don't believe that we're all individuals, and I don't believe we each fulfill ourselves. I think we live in a community.
I don't believe and I don't this and I don't that. I want to know who the I is that you're talking about if you don't believe in the individual.
Well, for the purposes of discussion, I need to use an I. But I live in a community.
The purposes of reality, you need
can
to
I,
use
can
an I. You're
absolutely.
Individual.
Christine, give us your bottom line there, Christine.
Let
please.
Me make my
sure,
point.
Sure.
We live in a community, and my happiness is not separate from my community. It's not separate from other people's happiness. If people are poor or starving or hungry, and I'm walking past them every day, that impinges on my happiness. And I don't feel that we can be truly fulfilled and happy unless we care about one another.
Christine, do you miss the time, daydream back to the times when you were lost in the romance of Howard Roark, or is that just plain behind you now?
It's behind me. It's the way a lot of other books that inspired me and philosophies that inspired me are behind me now. And I feel, also, I'm a little bit upset by the introduction of Christianity into this discussion, because I don't believe that the kind of Christianity touted by the religious right is really what Jesus, talked about.
Christine, we've got it. Just one stripe, and we've heard others. Thanks for your call tonight. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about the radical individualism of Ayn Rand. What is it that brings generations of readers again and again to Ayn Rand's door? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the radical individualism of Ayn Rand. She was born 100 years ago tomorrow in pre-Soviet Russia in St. Petersburg. Her father, a pharmacist, his pharmacy, and her rather nice life there was taken away. The rest, well, she came to America, and you know the story. The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, millions of copies sold, generations of readers who have come, some have stayed, some have gone. What about you? You can join us tonight. Is George W. Bush a Randian with his call for the free individual in the ownership society? And after the New Deal and Great Society, is Ayn Rand having the last laugh? Is America Randian? After all, we're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Washington by Edward Hudgens. He's executive director of the Objectivist Center, carrying on the legacy of Ayn Rand's thinking. Jack Beattie's with us. James Sturba, professor of philosophy at Notre Dame, is with us. And right now, from Los Angeles, we're joined by Barbara Brandon, an intimate friend and colleague of Ayn Rand for 18 years. She was a close friend. She was one of the members of the Rand Circle. She's author of the biography, The Passion of Ayn Rand. Barbara Brandon, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
I'm very happy to be with you.
You knew Ayn Rand very well. What do you think she would think of the United States in the year 2005 and the imprint that her style of thinking has on the culture, on the political life?
She had a great influence on the culture politically. She wouldn't like the culture today, by the way. She would like what her influence has been, but Ayn Rand was an advocate of reason, and reason is something very much missing from our world today, as can clearly be seen. So she would not be happy with it. She wasn't happy with it when she was alive, with the culture of her time. But she has had an influence. The fact that we have turned away from socialism to a great extent, the fact that one hears talk about individualism, all of that is due to Ayn Rand. She began it.
Describe Ayn Rand as a person. Your biography portrays her as having a kind of tempestuous personal life, personality. She certainly was productive. These enormous, great books with so many ideas packed into them. What kind of person was she?
She was a fascinating person. She for good and for bad. She was incredibly intelligent. Everybody who met her was instantly struck by the scope of her intelligence. It was vast. It truly was, almost hypnotic. She was a difficult person in many ways. She was hard to get along with often, hard on her friends very often, tremendously hardworking. I have never known anyone in my life who worked as hard as she did and who was as interested in ideas. That was her life. She had no small talk. She wasn't interested in it. She wanted only to talk ideas, and we would sometimes, her friends, and then she would stay up till 6 in the morning discussing ideas. And that was her idea of a wonderful time.
She was intimately involved in your life and your husband's life. One of it was Atlas Shrugged that was dedicated in part to him.
It was dedicated to her husband, Frank O'Connor, and to my then husband, Nathaniel Brandon, yes.
Who she, though a couple of decades older, took as a lover, your husband. What did you think about her philosophy of self-interest when that happened?
I was not thrilled, I must say. However, I said to you that she could be hypnotic. Mm-hmm. And she could be. She explained it to me. I was very young at the time. I was 22. in a way that it made sense to me. I thought I could live with it. I thought I could be happy with it. I discovered that was impossible. And as a matter of fact, it led really to catastrophe and to the shattering of lives. It ended very tragically. It should never have begun.
It's a lot to ask. What about Ayn Rand's own life in her later years? Was she satisfied with the arc of her life, with its impact? Did she die a happy individual?
I'm afraid she didn't. She was immensely satisfied with what she had created. A great source of happiness in her life was her books. They were what she had wanted them to be. She had started out in Russia at 9 years old wanting to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of her life, she had written the book she really wanted to write. But she wasn't happy with the state of the world. She wasn't happy with the state of America, with the irrationalism, the lack of freedom. She wasn't happy with most of the people she met. Towards the end of her life, her husband was very ill, and he later died. There was a lot of tragedy in her life, and she'd had a very, very hard struggle professionally, tremendously hard.
But those books were there, and they sold like crazy during her life and continued to sell a couple of 100,000 copies a year, as we understand. Barbara Brandon, thanks so much for sharing your personal reminiscences of Ayn Rand tonight.
My pleasure.
Barbara Brandon in Los Angeles, author of the biography The Passion of Ayn Rand. Michael's calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I think the fundamental flaw in Ayn Rand's philosophy is the supposition that people will act rationally.
It does depend on that, doesn't it?
I think history shows otherwise. I mean, I think people tend to be greedy. They want more for themselves. And when people get some wealth and power, they tend to use it to take unfair advantage of others. Look at corporate CEOs who lay off tens of thousands of people and then give themselves multi-million-dollar bonuses and then bribe the government to tilt the playing field to favor themselves even more.
Rand never maintained that, by the way.
Never maintained what, Edward Hudgens?
She never maintained that people will act rationally. And this is absolutely crucial. She said people should act rationally, that the first moral act is to focus your mind, to think or not to think. And the caller is absolutely right that many people choose not to think. Do you think Nazis really think, or Ku Klux Klan members, or radical Islamists, or some of these others? Do you think they're sitting around objectively trying to evaluate their own philosophy? Of course, the answer is no.
But if Ayn Rand if she didn't believe that people would act rationally necessarily,
they
that they should, was it
That's
then
right.
a matter of faith on her part that they someday
no.
would?
Mm-mm. No, 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 no.
But because in the absence of that, don't you get into just the kind of problems that our caller Michael's describing?
Because we have free will. Michael is right in the sense that we need a culture and a philosophy that tells people that your path to happiness in the highest sense is through reason. And by the way, let me give you an example. Do you think that a drug addict is a rational, reasonable, and happy person?
Well,
do
general,
you think a no? Yeah,
what's the point?
They clearly aren't. My point is this: that reason is a choice. Rand did not base her whole notion of freedom on the fact that people will act rational. She said, if people wish to survive, to prosper, to flourish, to get the most out of life, and by the way, to live in a society where you can take joy in your fellow citizens because they'll be doing the same sort of thing and achieving great things, then you have to act rationally.
James Sturba, at Notre Dame, let me ask you, do you think that Ayn Rand expected too much of humans in that case or not enough?
Just on the point of rationality, these people are acting rationally. The corporate executive that makes all that profit for themselves, that's perfectly rational. It's not moral, but it's rational.
But
so,
again, you have
so the idea that
morality.
We could grind everything on rationality, that's not going to do. That's not going to work here. We need morality. We could even use libertarian morality and respect everybody's freedom in a certain way and get to the right results. But we
can't
just use rationality.
the thing is, you want the tail wagging the dog. Let me say two things about business people, because one of the reasons why Rand is so popular is she didn't just write textbooks on economics. Mm-hmm. She wrote novels that were very inspiring because you actually saw, for example, Hank Reardon struggling for 10 years to create a new steel.
Industrialist.
But this is the point, that what they were getting out of what they were doing was money, but it was more, you might say, than money. Money was an indication of their virtue. But the thing is, it was the fact that they struggled, that they got the best out of themselves, that Howard Roark had to work to create beautiful buildings, that Reardon had to work over many years to come up with a new kind of steel. Okay,
it takes discipline, it takes hard work,
and that is part of the joy of any creation, whether it's a businessman creating a business plan, or whether it's an artist creating a beautiful statue, or a poem, or a beautiful symphony.
And bravo for that. Who wouldn't enjoy it? But James Sturba, you're pointing to Tyco and Enron and WorldCom.
Those executives are also enjoying their lives. They're very happy with their lives.
But the thing is, you assume somehow that theft, that stealing from other people is in your rational self-interest, which it is not.
James Sturba?
Theft is immoral, but it's frequently in people's rational self-interest.
No. This is a bastardization of rational self-interest. The notion that you see a rational self-interested person would love themselves so much that it would be abhorrent to them that they would basically live as a leech on other people. They would welcome the opportunity to make their own way. And by the way, I want to say, this is an immigrant country. My family, not the Hudgens, but the DiCamellos, were Italian immigrants who came over here. I worked my way up from a working class family. One of the wonderful things about this country, and one of the reasons we're very individualistic compared to, say, Europe, is because so many immigrants came over here, started at the bottom, worked hard, and took joy in the fact that they built their own lives. It was a reflection of them, that the business they created, the farm that they farmed, the family that they raised.
But they didn't all read Ayn Rand before they did that.
Right, and there are lots of people that stayed at the bottom after they came here, and they've been here for hundreds of years.
And the reason why they stayed at the bottom was either because of government repression, for example, legalized segregation and the sort of things that were done against
blacks.
Maybe,
or maybe they weren't Howard Roark. I want to get our callers in here. John's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Oh, they're lazy. John, you're on the air.
I just think that Ayn Rand's philosophy is entirely incomplete because it makes no mention of the unexceptional people that live in this world.
The people who are not geniuses, who are not blessed with the...
And that Howard Roark can afford to be uncompromising and individualistic because he has the guns to back it up.
In other words, he's got the intellect. He's got the talent, the guns, John said. Right. And so your concern there, John, is for the one who's not the great architect, not the great industrialist, period.
It's the same way with capitalism, in that capitalism has a very clear path for the innovators, for the geniuses, for the Bill Gateses, for the people that can create and really change the world.
Well, we hope it does.
Say anything about everyone else, the people that are just average, the people that are just normal, or even below average.
And the people that are average are not parasites and looters. They're just people struggling to make ends meet.
But here's the thing, a couple of important points. Number one, objectively, the people who are not, say, the Howard Roarks or the Bill Gates or the geniuses need the people who are. Because what makes their labor valuable is that somebody figures out how to put it to use. And those are the innovators, the entrepreneurs, and so forth. So they need the entrepreneur, number one. Number two, it's in a society like that that these people have the most opportunities to prosper. By the way, if you read Rand's novels, one of the interesting things is, for example, in The Fountainhead, one of Howard Roark's best friends is a day laborer, basically a construction worker who has much more integrity and joy in life than some of the rich characters who are Ayn Rand villains, such as the head of Taggart Transcontinental and Atlas Shrugged.
So good for both of them as long as the goods flow both ways. Let's get another call here. John is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks. What's on your mind, John?
Well, I remember reading Ayn Rand, and it was very inspirational to me. I consider myself an intellectual, and I remember fighting against what I consider anti-intellectualism. And even in the U.S. culture today, I think there's a lot of it. It was mentioned earlier how people are, you know, fighting notions of evolution, and I think the U.S. is one of the only places where in school, even in high school, you're sort of ridiculed if you do well.
So you're saying, bravo, Ayn Rand, even now, I see you're working on your PhD, and she's still in your corner.
She's still in my corner, but I think that at the same time, I actually also came from a household that was extremely poor. So I've had to work throughout my entire college career, and I found that a lot of the policies,
I did too.
Loans,
and me too, millions of Americans, and that's not so special. But where are you going with that, John?
Well, where I'm going with that is that a lot of my friends, a lot of intellectuals, the friends that I have at MIT, are basically they're not concerned with, you know, what's going to make money. And it seems that so much of Ayn Rand's philosophy is centered on money and selfishness of things like that. I think it might be misguided there.
Well, and yet, like you, she needed something to pay back that college loan. Jack Beatty, you're listening so patiently here. I wonder what you think of this conversation and how it weaves into the culture we're all maneuvering through right now.
Oh, I don't know that I can do that. But let me say this. Marvin Mursky, the computer scientist at MIT, has defined literature as an expert system in how people screw up. And taking it that way,
Marvin Minsky.
Taking it that way, you could almost say that a Howard Rourke, a character who quote wants to exist for his own sake, is a paradigm of how people can go wrong in life and of how something does not bring you happiness. And if this side of literature has a theme, it's the leitmotif of the novel Howard's End. Only connect. In some sense, that's the secret of life.
But Jack,
fulfilling your dreams.
But what about those entrepreneurs
as great as you can be?
Yeah, I hear that. But
connecting with others.
Hey, let's connect. I'm all for it.
Christine reminded us of that.
But what about those entrepreneurs who open up so many opportunities, not just for themselves, but for whole societies?
But today, the terms of cooperation.
Uh-huh.
That's the issue.
Mm-hmm.
If they set the terms of cooperation on their own terms, it may well be that the poor people don't get very much out of it.
But I think that we have to get beyond that point and get into some of the more philosophical issues that are being brought up by your callers.
You've got 30 seconds to do it.
Okay. Basically, I'm saying that the notion that somehow in a free society there are going to be people who just can't make it, I think is a fiction. Even the lowest person, even people considered poor today by the standards of today, are very, very well off compared to middle class and prosperous people 100 years ago. That's just a fiction.
So there's making it and there's making it, but there's still poverty.
Top to bottom can make it.
With that, we're going to have to say hip hip to Ayn Rand and read on. Edward Hudgens, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It's been fascinating.
More than welcome.
Edward Hudgens, Executive Director of the Objectivist Center. And James Sturba at Notre Dame, Professor of Philosophy. Very grateful to you for being with us tonight. Thanks for joining us. Jack, there you go. She still mixes it up 100 years after that birth in St. Petersburg in 1905.
She sure does. I remember seeing her talk. She was really a spellbinding lecturer.
Hypnotic, Barbara Brandon says,
yes,
and we believe
indeed.
It. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.